This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and descend. The horse is the white of the eyes, and the dark within.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Barnabaugh, and I'm joined with intergalactic space hobo Seth Dombach.
Hey, everybody.
And we're back with more Twin Peaks. I'm a little worried. I feel like I'm not sure if we're shooting the podcast in the foot here, because people can be like, they only do Twin Peaks. Let's forget about that. I'm done. But we didn't really plan to do an episode. We were going to do every two episodes once we caught up. But what happened was, it turns out, is there isn't going to be an episode next week. And last night's episode was so completely strange and out there that I felt like it really requires its own episode to discuss. So I don't know if that's going to be the case for – it really is going to depend, I think, on what Lynch gives us, because this is I think that this – there's a value in talking just about this episode, solely limiting it to what happens here. This is kind of Lynch, like, breaking the door off of, like, television.
Yeah. I really don't blowing know. It wide open.
Yes, I don't really know what else to say. So we've had seven episodes. This is episode eight. We're literally one episode away from being right at the midpoint, because there's going to be 18 episodes total. There is a hiatus next week. The previous week, episode seven, was kind of surprising in how linear and how willing it was to give us answers and move forward the story of Cooper and to move forward the mysteries that were happening in Twin Peaks and to kind of explore the characters and start to bring back in tie characters we knew with the characters that they've been introducing. I mean, they did so much that they even still had room for 7 minutes of, like, a guy sweeping a floor.
Yeah.
But maybe in a way that was – maybe this is the before and after, if you will. Maybe Lynch has gotten everything in – his pieces are all in place, and then he's like, let's do something completely different.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because you said that you're worried about the podcast. I'm a little bit more worried about my mental state after watching last night's episode.
Well, Sunday television is – I'm going to have to start, like, pacing these things out a little bit, because – I spent my Sunday evening was like just delirium, more or less. Thankfully, there's no American Gods right now for me to watch more of, because if I had watched American Gods and Twin Peaks and Preacher all back to back, I might not even be functioning right now. And before that, I watched Doctor Who. So it was just like I needed to watch, like, you know, just probably just
Bob Ross,
right? 20 minutes of that, though. I imagine there will be a Twin Peaks episode where it's just Bob Ross, a Bob Ross Mike in the blog.
Dr. Jacoby is Bob Ross.
Dr. Jacoby or Mike painting a picture of the tree, you know, of the arm.
Yeah.
happy little psychedelic alien trees. So let's get into this, because I feel like there's a lot we could say, and I want to belabor it, but we were kind of texting back and forth as this was going on. I think you were uploading your own Lynchian video to YouTube, I think, which I'll put the link to that and you could check it out. It's pretty it's definitely in the same esoteric vibe of the really out there experimental Lynch. And we've got bits and pieces of experimental Lynch, like, through this series, but last night was like he out-lynched himself.
Yeah. This episode should, like, have its own movement.
Yeah. Some people think that's a bowel movement.
Too. Yeah. Not us, but some people.
Yes. So episode eight, White Light, White Heat, which is an interesting title, but these titles don't tell you anything. I mean,
no.
When we now retrospect, I kind of get it. Okay. But it was funny because I texted you. The episode had just started, and I just said, hey, I think this is the weirdest one yet. And I wasn't even referring to where the whole thing sort of comes off the rails. To begin, well, go ahead.
It's funny because Nathan actually watched it before I did, and I texted him when I first started watching it, and I texted him about 5 minutes into the episode just saying, this is insane, and he texted me back, you haven't seen anything yet.
It's like the tip of the iceberg, the most normal scene in the entire episode. So I think not a recap, but we have to at least kind of explain what's going on.
Yeah.
What's interesting is there's probably about no more than 5 minutes of this episode that really ties into Twin Peaks in any way. I mean, there is a 5 minute like Nine Inch Nails musical performance there, which is very cool, and we're talking about. But I guess it happens in Twin Peaks, but I don't. I'm like, wow, you guys, your budget's gone up. You know, to be able to get the Nine Inch Nails, unless this is just a parallel world band, the Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, it could be.
There's 5 minutes. It's a pretty significant 5 minutes. It's very interesting because it deals with Killer Bob, but the plot itself, it's probably not fair to say the plot itself, but the immediate plot that we are dealing with is only moved forward very briefly in this 5 minute sequence.
Right.
After that, it just goes on a mind trip, a dream trip, just like a pure visual jaunt into the unknown.
It's really an art piece. Like, I could see it playing in a museum, honestly.
Yeah, and the one thing I will say, though, and I think that's why, if it was really just a bunch of crazy art images disconnected from everything, there will be no point to sit here and talk about it for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever. The reason I think it really bears merit to discuss is because I do think Lynch is telling a story. I think he's actually trying to tie his whole story together, and he's giving his story a big, like, he probably... Honestly, even though people aren't going to think this, or maybe don't think this, this is probably the most revealing episode.
Oh yeah,
in terms of the entire show, in some ways that we've gotten, what it actually is trying to provide for us, I believe, is the kind of essence of the show's mythology. What we've kind of had hinted at and pointed at. Seth, why don't you just talk a little bit about how it's been set up so far? Because I think it's worth let's start with that first scene. So we have last week Bob and Ray have got out of prison in a very weird way by holding dog legs ransom, sort of. He basically's got some dirt on the warden and they escape, and they get to just waltz out.
Yeah, so this episode starts with Evil Bob and Ray just driving at night, and Bob's trying to tell, you know, saying, you know, I need to find this code from you. You need to tell me this. And, you know, I bet you want to go to the farm, which you don't really know what that means, but, you know, you just assume it's someplace either bad or a safe place.
I was like, is the farm like when you put people out to pasture? You're going to the farm, old Yeller.
And you know, if you remember from like one of the earlier episodes, is Ray and Dario were trying to screw him over. So, you know, Bob is not going to be happy with him. So they you can tell there's like a very sinister undertone to their entire conversation.
Hey, wasn't there Big Ed's gas farm in the first?
Yes.
maybe they're headed to Big Ed's. He's got to come into the show at some point.
True. It'd be a great place to put him in too. But eventually, you know, Ray starts catching on that, you know, Bob is not doing what or taking him where he really should be going. So he, you know, thinks that he has to go pee, and they stop the car. And then Evil Bob finds a revolver in the glove box, and he's going to go shoot Ray. But meanwhile, Ray has tricked him and switched out his real gun and shoots Evil Bob, and Bob dies. Or you think he's going to be dead, until a bunch of ghost hobos come out of the woods and ascend upon his body and start pulling at his wound and rubbing his body covered in, like, full of blood. And then he sits up eventually. So, you know, just
well, he sits
early
up,
on.
But that's after they remove what looks like a spectral bowling ball.
That's
with
right.
Bob's head in it.
That's right.
So it seems that Evil Cooper gets back up. But the hobos seem to have removed Bob. At least that's what I was thinking, is that there's been like some separation of the two entities now.
Yeah, so that's within, this is literally within the first like 3 minutes of the show before it goes into the Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah,
but what really follows, like you said, this is a mythology. It's also kind of an origin story too.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. A couple brief mentions about that scene, that opening scene. So one thing is, Lynch and his, you could probably write an entire treatise on this. Lynch's like low lit old country back roads from the perspective of the car driver. I can't think of how many times I've seen that in movies, and it's basically disconcerting every single time he does it.
It's so effective.
It is effective. I feel like it was the primary kind of that style was a primary element, even probably the poster motif of Lost Highway.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's where he really sort of used it a lot, but it's happened a couple times already in Twin Peaks, and it's that feeling. I think he just likes that element of you're on the road and you have this idea of the boundaries, but then there's a twist and a turn. There's a twist, a turn, and swerving, and it's like, yeah, he's kind of setting you up. He's like, just like last week when he gave us all the stuff and then says, look, I swept it all up into a pile. And this week he starts by showing this twisty, windy road through the dark with a little bit of illumination in the very center. And he's like, yeah, this is what I feel like you could probably go through every Lynch episode and there's some visual cue about what he's about to do to you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if like next week just starts with a guy kicking some of the dude right in the junk. Get ready.
I would not be surprised by that at all.
But so two interesting elements of that is, and one thing is, were you kind of disappointed, like, when the hobos showed up, when these wee spectral creatures, which at first was like, are they Bigfoot? Because I feel like Twin Peaks, the original show, didn't it kind of tease elements of Bigfoot at a couple points?
Yeah, it felt like that, yeah.
It always felt like I was waiting for it to turn out that, like, Sasquatch had murdered Laura Palmer.
Yeah.
And there were a couple points in the early show. And then there also felt like it teased aliens. And there was a moment when these things were running out of the woods, and I was like, what is it? And then I realized that they are these kind of blackened spirits, if you will, four spirits. They're referred to as the Woodsmen. And which seems like a pretty good name for them. They're very creepy. They remind me of an old horror movie called Eyes of Fire. You've seen that?
Yeah.
That's trippy, too. It isn't as trippy as this, but it's trippy. And so they're like kind of creepy, spooky wood monsters. But they look like people, too. They look like they could almost be... there is the one among them who you know, we'll talk about. It looks like Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And the creature that was in the cell, we talked about that like a couple
weeks
ago.
Yeah, that's
right. It's definitely one of those same entities.
One of them just showed up on one of the last episodes. It was standing in the doorway, I think, at the Great Northern during that scene with the tone. I think it was only there for a few seconds.
Was it in the Great Northern? I thought it was in the... Maybe it was there, too. But there was one... The one I remembered was in the hospital when... not the hospital, but when the... military, the girl of the military goes to identify Briggs' body.
The
creepy kind of hobo person is walking back and forth. I think it was there. Though well could have been at the Great Northern. So they're definitely around. I don't remember I think they might have showed up in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, but I really need to rewatch.
Yeah, me
Fire
too.
Walk With Me. I see that if you have Showtime right now, which you would probably need to in order to be watching this, Fire Walk With Me is on Showtime. So, like, you can go back and catch up with that. I don't know if it's like what version of it is, because I think there's a couple versions out there. But either way, the other thing it reminds me of, and I know I've mentioned this before on our first podcast, they kind of remind me of that. Of the man behind the Winkies in Mulholland Drive, which was by far like the most terrifying part of that show. I feel like it's trying to pinpoint that this is the same kind of character, the same kind of force, entity, whatever they are. The question becomes, and it's explored a little bit as it go on, what role do they play? Because when they ran out of the woods, I almost was getting a feeling of like, you remember that movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze when anybody would die, these little goblins would like run out of the darkness? And that's a kind of classic motif in horror movies when the supernatural entity finally gets... How many times did Freddy Krueger get drugged into a pit or something by these dark forces? So I thought that's what was happening, but then they seem to grab Bob and run away with him, but then but Cooper, evil Cooper, seems to be revived.
Yeah.
Probably the most interesting element of that is Ray leaves and is like, hey, I think I killed him, but I'm not real sure. He's so nonchalant in the way he talks about that, too, because he's like, yeah. I think he got some help. But he also looks like he could be talking to Philip Jeffries, you know, the David Bowie character on the phone, who seems to be the person he's been in cahoots with, who seems to want Bob killed. But he's referring to him as Cooper. So it's almost like Ray doesn't know anything about Bob.
Yeah.
Because he says, I saw something that might be the key to the whole thing. And I assume when he's saying, I saw something, is the part where they pulled a Bob bowling ball out of Cooper. But he just says he got help. Not like there were crazy inner, you know, darkened spectral hobos came out and accosted him. Doesn't really say anything of that. And then he just sort of goes on. But I was a little disappointed at first because I thought, is this really Lynch could do this, because I believe nothing's off the table when it comes to Lynch. I was like, is he really? Is Cooper going to go down at the hands of Ray?
Yeah,
would be horrible.
That would be awful.
I mean, they clearly are building a kind of Cooper on Cooper sort of scenario. I feel like where we do want to see. Agent Cooper confront his doppelganger because he ran away from him the first time, you know, and it's possibly one of the reasons he's here in the first place, this scenario. We know that we kind of have to see him overcome it. So, but there's a moment where I thought, you know what, it's weird, but I don't want to see him go out like this.
No, yeah, Ray's such a, like, nothing character. You don't want to see him, you know, kill the main bad guy of the series.
No, but hey, you know, this is probably spoilers, but Stephen King did that.
That's true.
I mean, it does have precedent.
Yeah.
After a far more elaborate buildup of that, that particular character. And those two characters have things in common, so.
Yeah.
But then you go into the Nine Inch Nails scene where it's basically, now, where is that, the Roadhouse or whatever, where they just announce?
Yeah, they call it the Roadhouse, yeah.
And he just announced, he says, the Nine Inch Nails. And it's interesting. And you know what that made me think? It was years ago in the late 90s. Do you remember there was a point when Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails were actually, and this comes right after the scene where Ray is talking to Jeffries, they went on tour with David Bowie. Do you remember that?
Yeah, because they had that single together, I'm Afraid of Americans.
Yes, and so I remember it coming here to Baltimore, and there's a big sign that says David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails. And somebody who didn't know anything about it was like, what's David Bowie got Nine Inch Nails for? And I was like, he's back to his Ziggy Stardust costume. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. No, you got to get down with the hip kids music, which is no longer hip kids music. I mean, Trent Reznor is probably the same age David Bowie was at that point in time.
He's got to be at least in his 50s now.
Yeah, that was a cool sequence. That was cool.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
In any other episode, we'd be talking about that as the probably really strange kind of off-kilter thing they did, where they just literally have Nine Inch Nails perform with no context.
Yeah,
if you will. Love the song too. I mean, it was very, was very cool. But they're the tamest thing in the episode. Easily. So,
and that's where the rabbit hole begins.
That's where it does go off the rails. But I'm saying goes off the rails. I don't think it goes off the rails. I think this is amazing filmmaking. Some people are going to say it's pretentious. Some people are going to say, but as I've said in the past about some things, this is Lynch going up his own butt. But I really love things that are very visual and that are interestingly visual, that are willing to kind of go out there to take a chance to depart from the normal way that you tell a story. It just, the danger and the challenge of that is you got to make it work. If you can't make it work, there's almost no reason it's going to crash and burn. Well,
that brings up a perfect point, and I was just thinking about that earlier today. You know, there's a lot of people who try to do surrealism. You know, there's a lot of replication of people like Lynch and Bunuel and Dali and stuff like that. But a lot of people don't do it good, or they're just doing something weird for the sake of weird. But Lynch has a point behind it, and he is a true artist when it comes to creating things like this.
Yeah, I think so. And if you are someone who's followed Lynch's stuff, then you know, like, this is closest in spirit to Eraserhead. But what's interesting is Twin Peaks, even The Return, even in its most weird moments, it is still mostly affecting a narrative structure. We've had very Eraserhead-like moments in a couple of the episodes. We had that third episode where you watched Cooper escape from the Black Lodge and sort of be in the limbo zone between whatever the lodge is and back to the real world. And honestly, I thought that was as far as Lynch was going to be able to go to get away.
Yeah.
I was honestly astonished that he even went that far. We're watching this go on for so long and everything's in slow motion. It really, you've mentioned a couple times, I saw you were posting something today on Facebook about how it really feels like Lynch has captured what it feels like, not just to have a dream, but you specifically saying, hey, this is the way I dream.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's hard for me to explain my dreams without them sounding like kind of silly. And yet Lynch sort of captures that. And I agree. And I it's probably not just you. I think it's when you're watching it and it isn't, this is why he's so hard. He's such a hard filmmaker to replicate. And I don't think people should even try to replicate him. But every time someone tries to replicate Lynch, they just try to do weird things, you know?
Right.
Let's put some weird, I saw a really bad movie a couple years ago called The Rambler. Did you see that?
No, I haven't heard of that.
Yeah. There's several movies. I mean, we could all probably think of movies. There was a Greasy Strangler last year.
Yeah.
Movies that are just like, they think they can affect that kind of Lynch style, and the reality is it's so unique to him.
Yes.
And I wouldn't even call it a style. It's a sensibility, and it's a sensibility that kind of begins and ends with the things he cares about, the things he likes, the things he dreams about. And he's spent enough time analyzing the way he does that it affects him that I think he captures, hey, to a certain extent, I think all of us or many of us, enough for it to be familiar, process some of these images, because there's a weird feeling of comfort sometimes watching the images that happen here.
Yeah.
And then there's a weird moment of just like, you feel alien and far away, but there's familiar mixed with the totally bizarre and very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny you can say that, because I was feeling the exact same way. Like I'd mentioned in that post, you know, it is like my dreams are really strange, and this felt so like it felt like such a part of me. Like it literally felt like Lynch has like peeked into my subconscious and seen what resides within there and put it on the screen. Like just a scene, you know, where it's really hard to explain, but just you're like in a purple ocean and you're floating slowly up until you see this like craggy rock with a building on top of it, and you float into like a small little window. I'm just like who else is like putting this kind of thing on screen and making it work so effectively that you know, in the way that Lynch does?
And one scene basically just bleeds into the other in the sense that, as in a dream, you'll be in a room and you'll see a far-off room. And as a kid, I would have recurring dreams where I felt like I was exploring this sort of, for lack of a better term, some kind of foreign, and when I say foreign, I really mean like alien, you know, like country, a world that is not, you know, this kind of fantasy land where usually they will always be sort of abandoned. It's not like I'm walking around, there's tons of people to talk to, but like here's a Ferris wheel sitting on the end of a beach far off, but once you're close to that Ferris wheel, there's something else farther off, or there's something else. You're in one room, but now you're looking at what's in the room beyond that room. There's a sense in a dream a lot of times not to linger, but to kind of keep moving. Once one thing happens, it cycles through to something else, you know. And that scene you're talking about, which when I was looking at, I almost had like, oh, it's almost like the never-ending story, like the ivory tower, and which in its own way was trying to affect that, hey, this kid's fairy tale bedtime. But you keep getting closer, and is once you're back, once you go into the room, and what you see is inside the room on that castle, on that cliff, at the end of that ocean, which I'm sitting there thinking, is this the same ocean that Cooper's looking out of? And I wouldn't have been surprised if we had zoomed in and saw Cooper standing there on the top of the building.
That's
looking
what I thought was
going
to happen. Yeah, something like that.
So we're like all over this thing, which is probably fair because Lynch is too. But I was trying to describe this. It does feel there's elements of like when Terrence Malick does the Tree of Life, and he has that whole sort of creation of the universe. It's sort of, you know, this woman starts kind of praying to God, and you see his thing unfold. This is like the dark side version of that, and it's also mixed in with the Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite segment from 2001.
Oh, definitely.
I really feel like this is Lynch's homage to that. There are other very trippy movies I can think of that kind of came to mind. Dark City, Altered States. I mean, you could go on and on. And yet, it kind of wraps up, the last third of it is like an old 1950s horror movie, like yes. monster movie. And the first image is like that. So once you've got Nine Inch Nails, once you see the thing with Bob Cooper, it tells us like 1945, you know?
Yeah.
And it basically takes us right to the Manhattan Project.
And yeah, and you hear a countdown over, you know, a bleak black... It's in black and white. It's like pretty much the remainder of the episode is all in black and white.
Yes, and it's not just that, but it is pretty much the exact same image that has been that's in Cole's office, Gordon yeah. Cole's office. So it goes to White Sands. It goes literally inside the Mushroom Cloud, and yeah. as it's moving inside, you're getting all of this crazy sort of. The flotsam and jetsam and the chaos and the fire, the internal pieces of this swirling kind of maelstrom. It's very fascinating to watch, but you realize that that's the one thing is that Lynch still kind of, he doesn't telegraph plot points, but he does let you know, you know, you're watching it and you know, you basically can understand he's committing to this. We're going to be here for a little bit, you yeah. know? And I thought it's interesting because that piece of music that's yeah. playing. It definitely almost feels like the, you know, they kept the classical music that's used in 2001 Space Odyssey and in other movies, or, you know, classical music was actually used not just in 2001 Space Odyssey, but also in Tree of Life.
Yeah.
And here they did, I think, Lacrimosa, when the, you know, as it kind of pulls out, you see the creation of the universe. And this is Christoph yeah. Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, which is
yes,
sort
yeah.
of an appropriate choice. But it just, that image of the mushroom cloud is such a kind of iconic image. It's also an overused image. It's hard to know how to set a tone with an image like that.
Yeah.
But you had made a comment right before we started recording here that, like, you feel that maybe this is one of the most effective ways you've seen that atomic imagery used.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely was. It was something about the way that it started off. Like, you're not seeing it close up when it starts. It's very, like, it's a very wide shot of just this barren desert, and then you see the mushroom cloud happen. It's in combination with the music, which is very like atonal and like discordant, and just it's a slow pull into you going into the mushroom cloud itself, and just the starkness of like the black and white. I mean, the contrast of like the color, like the dark and the lights. There's something about it that just really hit me when I started seeing that, and then where you go from there is just, you know, in like an insane roller coaster ride into your, you know, deepest, darkest subconscious.
But he's always very careful to give you familiar images, to make yeah. you think of things, to tie things in. I mean, this is not someone just throwing things at the screen. I mean, so right. much so that this is the atomic bomb. When he goes inside of that cloud, he basically is giving us almost like the Big Bang. Like,
yeah.
Which is why I think the Tree of Life comparison is there. You're watching this spark that starts life. This is yeah. a spark of chaos. And I guess the important thing to, like, when we started going there, I remembered as season two of Twin Peaks started wrapping up, and correct me if I'm wrong, Seth, it really felt like we were starting to get some weird, more supernatural, mystical yeah. elements. And I thought, like, particularly some of the stuff involving Briggs seemed to start underlying possibly like aliens or right. more science fiction-y. This was well before the X-Files, but that kind of a vibe.
Yeah,
where
definitely.
We didn't just have mystical, like, wood spirits. We had that, but we felt like we were starting to go down the road of, like, alien abductions or something. And when yeah. we saw that mushroom cloud, even though mushroom clouds don't necessarily, you know, scream aliens, it does evoke 50s kind of science fiction. It evokes Godzilla. It evokes things like that. And the minute I saw that, I thought, I wonder if this isn't going to be, you know, we're thrown back to 1945. This is the origin. But the origin of yeah. what? What are we yeah. going to have explained here? And it kind of plays out like a classic mythology story, like someone yeah. trying to explain the birth of their mythology, of their gods. And even though we do know that the characters in the Black Lodge, the Black Lodge itself and most of the characters have do predate 1945, we don't know whether Bob predates 1945.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I was thinking when I watched this scene, because pretty much I think it's right after you start seeing like some of the weirdness when you go into the mushroom cloud, you get like shocked into this void where this creature, it almost kind of, it looks similar to the thing that was in the box in the first episode, but it's more realized. You can see its full body, and it just starts vomiting out this string of just whatever, like viscera, and within that is a ball that's containing the head of Bob in here. And you know, while some people might just kind of write this off as nothing, like you said, it is like a mythology. You think of like the Greek mythology, and a lot of that, you know, like some of the Zeus mythology is very strange like that. And what I got from it is that this is, you know, this bomb set off, you know, this other dimension coming into our realm, and this creature is like some sort of deity that can vomit things into existence. And as we see what
it
happens,
gave me a
kind
Pandora's
of
box sort of feel,
yeah,
to it.
Where, definitely.
And it has the, like, I'm pretty sure it is the same creature that was in the box, which if you remember the way that appeared, it had a very gray alien kind of look to it.
Yeah.
But the thing that shows up here has almost like, looks like the body of a, like almost like a Greek statue of a woman's body, kind of a little bit like a harpy or something. But then the head is like the evolution of the arm. It's like the evil,
yeah,
arm doppelganger's head. It's that little circular head, and it's just vomiting this forth. And the way this stuff is moving, and you see all these different pieces. And again, it's that like tree of life when you see the soup of life kind of coming together, except here comes a big floating bulb with Frank Silva's head grinning out, yeah, of it. And that's disturbing pretty much every, yeah, time you see it. But so that happens. We see that, and then we start going at some point after there's one moment, and I just wanted to take a picture of it. It almost was like made me think of The Outer Limits. There's a moment where Lynch seems to only have white flecky static on screen for like 2 yeah, minutes. It's just shooting back and forth, and you hear this weird sounds of what sounds like frying electrical equipment,
yeah,
or like someone just like bugs just falling into a zapper. It's hard to really
know. And you hear that later on in this episode too.
Yeah, the soundscape is every bit as important as the visual scape, I,
yeah,
think. And you go across this ocean, which again feels like this kind of limitless, vast sea. And we zoom in on this kind of cliff. And this is where the mythological elements really come in, where you have that far-off land kind of feel.
Yeah.
And this world that exists beyond time and space. And I mean, none of that said. It just, that's what he's evoking visually. And you kind of go in and you come into this through this window. And then you're in this room, which is kind of reminds me of the Silencio in, like,
yes, yeah,
right, in yeah, Mulholland Drive, one of the most strange sequences in Mulholland Drive. And it looks like the realm of where the giant lives.
Yeah.
And the giant, you remember the giant had often talked about that where he's from, they play music all the time, that we have,
yeah,
music. And there's music, there's strange kind of music playing here. And there's another character with the giant. And it's funny because, yeah, I'm like, is the giant watching the latest episode of Twin Peaks? Yeah. And there's a part where I'm like, and I could totally see Lynch just having us watch him watch the whole thing over again from the beginning.
Yeah. Nothing would surprise me. At this
right.
point.
And so they're sort of viewing this, and you do get this kind of out of time feel. And what's weird about the out of time is, the giant seems, would you think it's fair to say the giant seems like he dies here?
Yeah, it almost gives that feeling. Like what I kind of got from this scene is I feel like these are like the almost protector entities, because they're sitting in a room and this music's playing, and then all of a sudden this alarm starts going off on this big, like almost like bell looking thing, and he goes and shuts it off, and then ends up like walking into what looks like a old theater style, and ends up floating up into the air, and with this golden stuff kind of shooting out of his head, and you can fill in what happens from there, Nathan.
Right, and so it almost does feel like that, like the alarm starts going, so that in case of emergency, break the glass, like that's,
yeah,
kind of what he does here. But it's interesting because, yes, it's almost like his life essence or his spiritual essence starts kind of just floating out of this crack in the back of his head, which is where it seems like to me you've got that image of him sort of sacrificing himself. They are images that relate to all kinds of different religions. Pretty much any sort of religion where you have a deity figure sacrificing themselves, you have God sending his son within Christian religions. You've got many religions where the world is actually born out of the body of a god. You mentioned Zeus. I mean, Zeus has Athena sprout directly out of his head.
Yeah.
Which is probably the closest comparison I have here, because when this energy comes out, there's another character who seems to be a female character whose last name is like Dame Silencio or something like that. Sometimes I feel like it's as bad with a Lynch movie as it is with a Star Wars movie, where you have all these characters' names that I have no clue of. It's like, you didn't name those in the movie. There need to be more Lynch action figures. I want to get a little, one of those little...
We need Porkins. Yes. The Porkins, the Lynch version of Porkins.
Well, he was. There's that story about he was going to direct Return of the Jedi.
Oh yeah.
At one point, that'd have been amazing.
Yeah.
The Ewoks all would have looked like those crazy bums. And but that scene when after this happens and the woman is there with him who like halfway between an opera singer and halfway between a lounge singer, you know,
yeah,
a lot of
yeah.
strange stuff. And there's this neat kind of monochrome. But, you know, you've got the black and white, but then you have moments of color kind of. And the whole design of this place is really cool. This is where I started to feel more like the German Expressionism. And
oh,
I think
yeah.
with that entity or that, like, that golden dust coming out of his head, that reminded me kind of Dark City. You know, if you've seen Dark City, those characters have aliens that sort of sprout out of the back of their heads. And then there's another gold ball. And this one... it has Laura Palmer's face in it.
Yeah.
And it comes down, and the lady sort of kisses it and kind of sends it out into the world. And it's like they're counteracting what this monster has just done.
Yeah.
And also, when you see Bob's head swirling out, you also see these floating eggs and whatnot. So in both imagery, there's this imagery of these things being sent off into the world to be born. So we see Laura Palmer. Well, I don't know if it's Laura Palmer, but we see her face reflected in there. I can't tell if this ball is sort of... reflecting just, hey, this is the experiences of things that happen in Twin Peaks, where it is in some way containing the spirit or soul or substance of Laura Palmer. I think it's worth mentioning that in the first series, the giant, we assume, is in some ways a relative, I guess that's also a relative term, but a relative to characters like the Man from Another Place.
Right.
And if you remember the Man from Another Place... who is Mike, but then at one point he is also Michael Anderson. You remember that he tells Cooper in a dream sequence when he meets Laura, he goes, "That's my cousin. Doesn't she look just like Laura Palmer?"
Yeah.
And I always thought that was weird. I didn't know that meant anything, but there's this kind of strange thought where he acknowledges that this entity is something like me, but hey, it looks like Laura Palmer. So I don't know. Maybe that there's something to that.
Yeah.
But it kind of floats out, and then we kind of move out of some of the major trippiness in that sequence. And I know I'm doing things out of order because I can't remember exactly how they happened, but I'm just trying to think cosmically, dealing with the characters that feel like these god characters, the high on Olympus. Like, that's basically what's limited to that. We see the giant. I feel like he's dead. I don't know. We don't see him doing anything else. Maybe he comes back. This is where the cyclical feel comes in, though, because it seems possible if characters who are omniscient or omnipotent can be at any point in time, so time is always a loop for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which means this demon creature, we're watching it come down, and we're assuming we're seeing the past, which we are in a sense. But I don't think Lynch thinks in terms of the past or the future.
No.
And so this demon could be coming right. The last thing he could have done, for all we know, is mauled those people in the apartment when he was chasing Cooper and then come here. Which means maybe the bob head that he has is the one that the creepy little hobos just gave him back. Maybe it all is a cycle. You know, once Bob is removed and not actually sent back to Lodge, he gets sent back to be born at this moment, this cacophonous moment inside of this atomic weapon. So there's either the possibility that the atomic weapons wake him up, or chaos is the natural incubator for this sort of evil.
Yeah.
And which does start to bring up a question of who are and what exactly are they doing, these these creepy black spirits, these creepy, like, they almost seem like zombies the way they're introduced, because after that,
I had that feeling too.
After that phantasmagoric kind of sequences where it's very abstract, experimental, it then becomes like a 1950s horror movie, like I said, even with a very weird egg hatching scene. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so after the scene with them sending the ball with Laura's face back to Earth, or to Earth in the first place, we cut back to, I think it's like 1950-something or 1965 or something like that.
Moves into, and, like, 1954, I believe.
1954, yeah. And we see, like, the desert, and in the desert is just this tiny little egg, and we watch it hatch, and this thing that looks like a mix between, like, a frog and some kind of insect crawls out of this egg and, like, slowly starts crawling across the sand. And this comes completely out of nowhere. We don't know what this thing is. We've never seen anything like this in Twin Peaks before. So this is, you know, brand new to us.
For the next 3 minutes until we see something even weirder.
Yeah, it's a really starkly beautiful scene, the way that it's shot. Like, it's the close-up of, like, the almost kind of the design of the sand and the way that the egg's sitting in it. It's just, like, there's so many things that you could just frame as, like, a work of strange, like, almost H.R. Giger-style, like, weird art.
It is, and it feels like you're watching a nature documentary from hell. Like,
yeah.
This thing hatches, and it comes out, and it looks realistic. It doesn't even look fake. Like, you know, like, it's a weird mix of, like, trick photography and CGI, and it, like, really works. It's you're like, what is that exactly?
It's like the baby from Eraserhead.
I honestly thought it was going to be the baby. There was a moment, because I was watching this on the TV upstairs, which is a little smaller than the other TVs, and I was actually, like, I found myself get up out of bed, which I was trying to wake my wife, because she'd be like, what are you watching? It's so disturbing. Actually, her issue with this new Twin Peaks is it's so lulling. She's like, it's so relaxing. It just puts you into this sort of, like, fugue state.
It's like a meditation.
Huh?
It's like a meditation.
It is. Well, you know, Lynch is big on meditation, so I'm not surprised. I think he is really trying to be sort of, like, educational in a way with some of the stuff where he's trying to let people experience. And I think the pacing has shown that he wants people to linger and think and exist in a moment. And some of those moments are weirder than others. But when this thing hatches, and it almost reminds you of, like, the openings of, like, Creature from the Black Lagoon, when we were hearing about, you know, the eons ago when these creatures first crawled from the water. And yet it's juxtaposed right after we've watched, even though this is years later, we are watching this happen essentially after we see the Bob egg and the Laura egg, and then we're watching this thing hatch. And my first inclination is that this is one of them, or maybe it's something else completely different, you know, maybe it's another entity. But there's this kind of feeling of that, you know, the beast slouching towards Bethlehem to be born. It's almost like something has just made its way into the world. What we were just watching is what happens on the cosmic level, and now we're back to a degree, we're back to the tangible real world.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, like, from here, like Nathan said, it does remind you of, like, that 1950s style, you know, and even more so because it starts with, like, the atomic bomb, and, you know, that was a huge factor in a lot of the horror movies back then. But then go ahead.
No, go ahead.
We do get some of these scenes with you know, the ghost hobos. That's how I can only refer to them from now on. The woodsmen. You know, we see them, like, come upon, like, an older couple in their car at nighttime, and they come along with, like, almost like a static electricity. You just hear this, like, crackling sound, and they speak with this, like, weird reverb in their voice. So the guy, he just comes up with, like, a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and he's just like, got a light.
Did that make you think of that creep show episode? Hey, lady, thanks for the ride.
Thanks for the ride, yeah. Thanks for the ride, lady.
But even the way they appear, it's like almost like zombies or marshmen or something, because it seems like there's this catalyst. Like you said, we've got Lynch is, like, checking all the boxes. There's the atomic imagery. Here's the strange creature hatching. And we get it's bug-like and insect-like, and it makes you think of an old 50s giant bug monster movie. And then you see these zombies kind of, like, that scene where they're walking out of the, like, the woods and the darkness on the side of the road is not that different than George Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Right,
you know what
yeah,
I mean? Like
yeah.
the way they come up. And the first one we see looks like a burnt up Lincoln.
Yeah.
He's played by this actor, Robert Brodsky, that you and I just looked up before this. And he has made about 7 or 8 other things outside of this, and he has played Abraham Lincoln in every single one. If you look up IMDb and look a picture of him, he's even in a movie called Link Clone, where he plays like an evil robotic Lincoln or something. This was not by accident. I don't know if there's an actual reasoning behind this. I didn't pay enough attention. I couldn't make out the rest of the woodsmen to find out if there's like an Andrew Jackson woodsman in there or a Howard Taft woodsman. I don't know. That would be interesting to maybe see if there's other woodsmen that look like somebody. But this guy, he definitely is. He's kind of like, it's just enough to make you think that kind of looks like Abraham Lincoln, but he's pretty deranged. But you're just watching them kind of meander through. You're watching this little creature make its way somewhere. And then you have another classic 50s kind of image, which is a young boy and a young girl kind of walking together. And where they're at now, their location isn't that far off, like, from Twin Peaks at this point. Like, the location. So, and I'm starting to think maybe I should know who these people are. You know, I'll let you go. But before we do that, let's talk about the one scene that I think is the last, not the last, but it's definitely the one of the other weirdest scenes is, and you've talked about it a couple times, right, is the gas station.
Yeah. Yeah, so we get a scene of, you know, you're just right outside of a gas station, and the frame rate starts kind of jumping. You start hearing this crackling, and this weird, like, fog starts rolling outside of the gas station. And then all of these, the woodsman creatures, they just start, like, appearing and, like, jumping back and forth. Like, the frame is, like, literally, like, cutting, like, multiple spaces out. And then, like, they just kind of, this is kind of like their almost like origin of like how they've like come into this realm. But there's something, like, it goes on for at least like 2 or 3 minutes.
It feels
it's
like time lapse photography of like a weird way station where they seem to be phasing in and out. And it's like they're busy, they're doing something. It's just weird. And at first, I was waiting to see them like building, you know, I was waiting to see it get bigger, the gas station sort of. Because what's weird is when they're first there at that gas station, and they're moving back and forth, and you kind of see it, and you're thinking like old 50s, like convenience store, gas station, you know?
Yeah.
Remember that in that Mike, he mentions like, hey, we used to like, maybe I'm making this up. Doesn't he mention something about living above a convenience store? Or, hey, we used to be in a, and there's a,
yeah,
there are
there's something in Fire Walk With Me too.
Fire Walk With Me, there's a bunch of these lodge entities living in, like, in a convenience store above like a gas station or something. And so I was wondering, I was like, are we gonna watch, I honestly thought, are we gonna watch these creepy little guys build onto this, and it's eventually gonna have a second story, and it's like, hey, that's where they he has that mention about something about the corn or something, and it's like
this is actually the recruitment video for the 7-Eleven if you get a job there.
In and out, gotta make the beetle frogs. But it's crazy, and it goes on, and you're watching it, and it's just fascinating to look at just as an image. But like you said, there's that kind of dream feel where we're watching something go on for a long time, but it just feels like the natural order or unnatural order of these particular creatures.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating, because we don't Lynch is never going to tell us anything substantial about these guys. I don't think we're just going to learn what we can. So they seem to have come in the world at this point. They seem like I don't know, are they like the time bandits? I can't figure out what, you know. They seem like they're minions of some sort, some kind of henchmen. They are not. They don't strike me as characters like Mike or Bob, who sort of strike me as almost like dark angels, fallen angels sorts of characters. I mean, they feel like those characters feel like they're an upper tier echelon, not the highest tier of whatever spiritual development is here, but they're a pretty high tier.
These are like Hive. This is like a Hive.
Yes, this is like like we said, got to make the donuts, and they're sent out seemingly on this mission, and they almost like the orcs, you know, and they almost kind of look like orcs in some ways. But they then, but it also kind of has that feel of the John Carpenter's The Fog a little bit.
Yeah,
because they make their way to the radio station, and it gets gruesome again. We have to have some shot of you know, Lincoln smashing some girl's skull with his bare hands, and then he recites that little bit of whatever that is, poetry. It came off of a fortune cookie. It was in the back of a Cracker Jack's box. I don't know, whatever it was. He recites that, and it seems to put everybody in a, puts everybody to sleep, just knocks them out, seemingly. At which point, when they're knocked out, the beetle frog climbs into the house of the young woman and climbs down her throat. And
in a disturbingly real sequence.
In a very gross, like, Lynch is like, hey, you know what? I have this beetle frog we made. Can you swallow this? And kind of films it that way. It's very bizarre. And, of course, the final, he kind of throws you for a bit there because I don't remember what the very last image is, but it basically wrapping it up at that point. You know, we kind of see the ghostly hobos depart and go back to their great dumpster in the sky or wherever they came from. And at that point, the final shot is we go back to her laying on the ground there, presumably after the bug has gone down her throat. And that's more or less it.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's just over the credits, you just see her like laying there as the credits roll.
Yeah, and but you keep waiting, is it going to come back up? But no.
So I have a theory about this. I don't know how right this is. I don't know if we'll ever get any kind of resolution on this, but
I think we have to, honestly. I think
It feels like he set something up that he has to like pull into this. But I don't know how you feel about this, but my thoughts are that this is Sarah Palmer as a kid.
I'm pretty certain that that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because one thing too that caught my mind in the thing that the woodsmen are saying over and over again, they say this might be me just reaching really hard, but at the end, the last line of it is the horse is the white of the eyes and the dark within. I don't know if you remember. I don't think it's in Twin Peaks. I think it's in Fire Walk With Me, where Sarah Palmer like has a vision of a white horse. Standing in her room, it just like shows up out of nowhere and then just kind of disappears. Do you remember that scene, Nathan?
Yes, I do. And it was kind of weird, creepy. I was like, wait, was that Halloween, the Rob Zombie's Halloween, or was it Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me? I think it was both. But there's that. There's also that whole quote that Fire Walk With Me comes from.
Yeah.
And the first part of that, isn't the first part of that speaking about kind of being born or out of fire or something like that? I'm trying to remember the full-blown quote. But that entire bit has a reminiscence of sort of acknowledging, hey, you're kind of coming from somewhere else. If you listen to this, and I don't know how literal this is supposed to be, but a lot of the elements in the Nine Inch Nails song, if you take them at their literal face value, they describe a lot of what's happening in the episode, just in terms of just pure visceral what's happening. And the other thing, the white of the eye, or the horse is the white of the eyes and the dark of the soul. You remember that, like, when the characters when Leland dies in the original show, he's got Bob inside of him, and he dies of, like, a wound to the head. You remember?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And he dies, but Killer Bob doesn't die, or Evil Cooper doesn't die when he's shot with a gun. I don't know if that's because of the arrival of the hobos, or it's simply that the doppelgangers are different than normal human beings.
Yeah.
Or a doppelganger with Bob riding piggyback is different than Bob just possessing a human host.
Yeah.
And the doppelgangers have the white eyes, like when they're in the lodge.
Right,
remember?
Yeah.
Like, but when they're in the real world, they have dark black soulless eyes. So that juxtaposition I thought about, too. And what's weird, in lots of Lynch's stories, though, bugs and things are usually signs of rot or discontent or disruption.
Like a Blue Velvet.
Malignance. Yes, the opening with the Beatles under the ground. But here, I really don't... I'm sitting here looking at this, and I'm like, I don't think that this beetle frog is supposed to be a malevolent spirit. I don't think so either.
I felt the same way, because I think this is... I was thinking about this earlier, too. Like, I feel like these things that have come into the world, like, they've not yet had a chance to, like, really possess things. They can't just take things over. Like, the woodsman, like, instead of just possessing somebody, he's, like, literally, like, pushing his fingers into the back of the dude's head. But I feel like this, with this bug, I think it's actually sent by, like, the giant. Because I feel like once they can, like, possess somebody, and when the girl, like, grows up and has a child, it's a mix between, like, these interdimensional beings and a human. And that is why, like, they can create somebody who has, like, this mystical nature to her that way. Which is why Cooper is drawn to Twin Peaks, which is, like, the hub and center of, you know, like, the entryway to these different dimensions.
And I think there are going to be people who don't like that, who are going to think in some ways, I don't think this is remotely the same, but there are going to be people that think in the same kind of context of how when Ridley Scott goes back and sort of jettisons a lot of his stuff and does Prometheus, or even more egregiously, George Lucas doing midichlorians, you know? In a certain sense, Lynch is kind of going back here and casting his entire story in a much larger, wider scope, because if what he's saying here is true, then everything that Cooper does and everything that Laura Palmer does and Leland Palmer does, it's all more predestined or preordained in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And suddenly it's not a quite, you know, we always watch these shows like X-Files or X-Files, you know, okay, they're investigating it. That's why they run across this crazy crap. But you ever, like, how do we pack so much weirdness into one town? Why is everything related to Laura Palmer? She's the girl that died. Well, no, she's not just a girl that died.
Yeah.
And I think that that's going to be significant because we've seen that Laura Palmer is not gone. And we might be on our way to learn that the Laura Palmer that did die was maybe an entity that lost its ability to recognize who it was.
Yeah.
And maybe Bob is trying to destroy her specifically for that reason. In the same way that when Cooper gets back, he can't remember being Cooper. He's kind of stuck there, you know, this weird idea of, this is just me just totally spitballing, but, you know, what if Laura Palmer grows up? It's that kind of thing of, like, when people do look at stories involving deities, like, well, even through Christ, well, at what point does he know he's the Son of God? And what if he went a long time just being a, you know, a normal person without that information, you
right.
know? Can you have deity in you, and you just, you know, while you should be defending the universe, you're out here, you know, sleeping with dudes and running amok and doing drugs, you know, kind of a complete waste of a demigod at that point. But and I could be way off base with that, but I think that Lynch has opened up that doorway to think what I think this episode is doing. It's not giving an exposition dump to explain everything away. I do think it's the origin story of Bob. I think it's also going to provide a context for a way in which we can see what these characters do coming up. And I think maybe one of the most important aspects of that is that Laura Palmer's story is not done. She's still out there somewhere. Presumably she's on Earth again.
Yeah.
And that also begs the question of the cyclical nature. We are thinking we're seeing Laura Palmer created in that moment. And this is the first time we see her. We're thinking Bob is created in that moment. But if it's a cyclical thing, maybe this is how Laura Palmer gets back into the world. And it also is her origin story in a sense. You know, Lynch, I think, has left the door open for this to be cyclical, the birth-death sort of cycle, that Laura Palmer, when she's chucked out of the Black Lodge, is put into this golden ball, born out of the giant's energies or whatever, and then sent out into the world. And you mentioned, I think you're right on the money about that, because if you look at the age, I mean, we can't use information like this to make absolute certainties, but if you look at the age of Frank Silva, who is passed on now, but the actress who plays Sarah Palmer, their ages match up, where Frank Silva born about 1945-46. So if you have him coming into the world at that point, and let's just say he does grow up. You remember that Leland Palmer mentions living near a guy, or his grandfather, somebody lived near somebody who, the Bob was someone who lived near him.
Yeah.
And where he talks about growing up, I believe, is the same vicinity that we are in 1956. If we're saying that their actual biological ages of the actors are similar, they're just about the right ages to be about 10 to 15 year old mm-hmm. kids,
yeah.
which is what we're seeing there. And that seems to match up. And they're in the same locale that they would have been in as kids. So I think that's pretty much, I can't say it's a sure thing, but I think that is what he's showing us, is the genesis of Laura Palmer. Now, and maybe this frog thing stays inside for a while, and then, Laura's born that way. I don't know how much more of the story we're going to get. This might be all we ever get.
Yeah. We'll just have to see. We're almost there.
We are, but, it might just be another, weird... But that's the last thing I want to talk about, just for a couple minutes. Said, how did you feel about watching an episode like this? Because yes, we want to get into a tendency where we want to see the story move forward. We want to learn new answers, mysteries. For me, I'm getting to where I like enough of these characters. I want to spend more time with them, like some of our new characters. Like, hey,
yeah,
let's get a little bit more time with the new Truman character, with Frank Truman. Love a little more time with Janie, things like that. But when you see an episode like this, which kind of does confound, I think, our expectations for that week-to-week serialized show, what'd you think about it?
See, I really love stuff like this when it's done well. Like, even, like Jodorowsky, stuff like that. But, and then, obviously Lynch. So, for me, like, this did not... Like, I wasn't disappointed in any way that the fact that I wasn't, like, seeing the story move forward, or that I wasn't catching up and see, is Dougie getting back more to Cooper now? Like, something like this, just because it's handled so well, I was with it, and I was excited. Like, my mouth was probably hanging open the entire way through that show last night, and seeing something like that, and I love that David Lynch, like, has the balls to do something like that with, halfway through this series, because we're probably not going to get another season of Twin Peaks. I highly doubt that's going to happen after this. But, but I mean, like, this is something, like, you never expect to see anything like this. It really isn't TV, and it really isn't a film. It really transcends to that, like, level of art that you don't really see that often. There's a few directors and a few creators who have been able to get that level, but being able to see that he still has the ability to make something like this, it's just like, it really makes you appreciate, like, the imagination and what it takes to come up with something like that.
I feel like he's kind of watched everybody, like, these True Detective and everything kind of come through, and like, oh, we're going to be a little Lynchy. And he's like, no.
You've seen the rest, now see the best.
Yeah. And we've had so much of that kind of stuff. I agree. I was actually kind of like I mentioned, I like stood up and walked closer to the I was probably looked like I was a zombie myself, like, because I was just standing in front of it staring. Like, I was trying to get as close as I could because so many weird images going on. I was like, I want to see this as closely as I can. And it's really, it's invigorating to see something like that, I think. You don't want to necessarily see this all the time. Not everyone. The message here is don't go out and do this to all of your shows, because for one thing, it isn't going to work.
Yeah.
You have to know what you're doing. You have to be inclined this way. This is not the first time Lynch has done this. He's just gone to such a level, but shows that he can. And it's going to keep the show fresh. I think I mentioned to you, like, it's funny because Game of Thrones is about to come back. I watch Game of Thrones. I don't like love it. I think it's more like one of those experiences of, I want to watch it as it's happening and unfolding, and
yeah.
I enjoy pieces of it. Have you watched any of it, Seth?
Yeah, I like it. I'm the same way. I don't feel like it's as great as everybody else thinks it is, but it's
pulpy fantasy.
Yeah, it's fun enough. It's not that level. It's the same way with The Walking Dead. I feel the same way about that.
Most shows on television are like that. We watch week to week. We spend a lot of time with them. We spend a lot of time invested in them. But at the end of the day, most of the time, we're just kind of watching a little bit of a story. I mean, I enjoy the fact that over since Lost and some of these other shows, we've gotten into more of a serialized show that tells one continual story.
Right.
So what we get week to week is building of story. It's not scenarios. Like, even X-Files, week to week, it's Mulder and Scully doing something, and the story gets moved forward a little bit, but it's this, you know, that's why there could be so many CSIs and stuff like that, because it's just a bunch of characters solving mysteries every week, and we don't really care about them as characters. They're just basically boilerplate, and you're watching some actors you like solve mysteries. There's nothing wrong with that. What becomes problematic with the other attempt is it almost only really works when you get something like Netflix, where you can binge watch the whole thing at one time.
Yeah.
Because it's like, here's the whole story. How do you keep it fresh enough that week to week, I just don't feel like... Because that's how I watch Doctor Who. I'm like, oh, I'm excited. And then when it's done, I'm like, well, I learned about one, two things. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I've got about two pieces of information. Watching Lost, watching Walking Dead is like that. You know, you get a little bit of information. You're moving incrementally forward. Lynch seems to really want to, particularly this episode. It's just like, let me make this episode mean something. Let's every time you tune into this show, it's going to be an experience. If you forget and don't care about what you learn or don't learn, this is going to be an experience. And I feel like he's delivered on that eight times now. I have never been bored a single moment. I've been befuddled. I've been almost put to sleep. I've been lulled into a trance. I've never been bored, though, with what's happening.
Yeah, it's been incredible throughout. Like, this is... Like, I couldn't even imagine that it could be as great as this is. Like, this is really... Like, I don't want to see... Like you said, I don't want to see the imitation of this, but I feel like this is a very... This is going to be like a land point, even if it's not to like that many people. I think it's like a land point in television creation and what it can be.
I'll be honest. I thought he was done, and I don't mean that like washed up, because and sadly, you and I were talking. In fact, we're thinking of doing a series about like overrated directors.
Yeah.
And I definitely don't put Lynch among those. And yet I think we came to a point, this is just texting back and forth, but it's like, there is a difference between overrated directors who have just, their work is just, people like it a lot more than I personally maybe think they should.
Right.
And directors who were great once and aren't great anymore. And, you know, we talked about guys, John Carpenter, Francis Ford Coppola, guys working around the same time frame as Lynch. And then Lynch, you know, some of his stronger work I thought was even later, but then like Inland Empire, I didn't know that I just didn't think he had the interest to go back and do any kind of long form thing in visual. I mean, he's done music, he's made coffee apparently, he's done just about every other little, he does fine art, that I wasn't really thinking he had much interest in coming back. And I never thought that Lynch would want to come back and do something like Twin Peaks, because of the kind of commercial sort of serialized nature. Like, that's not really in him, or never felt like it was in him. So he clearly had a story to tell, a story he is telling, and I think it's making the old work better for it, for existing.
Yeah, definitely. Well,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it really blows my mind to think that, you know, you can come back for such a long, because I think Inland Empire, that was probably like 2006, 2007?
That's exactly right, 2006. And I feel like he's accomplishing with this what he was trying to do with Inland Empire.
Yeah.
And somebody made an interesting statement. It wasn't a full-blown review, but I saw somebody post a blurb or something on Twitter or something where they said, you know, as a standalone, if I came to this as a standalone art piece, it'd be interesting, but it'd be cool, but without really knowing anything about it, you know, these days I've seen so much, it'd be all right. But the fact that it is tied to some it is dealing with Twin Peaks mythology.
Yeah.
It is in the middle of what is in some ways a show with a narrative structure where it cares about things like, where's that noise in the lodge coming from? You know what I mean? Like, it seemingly has these other mundane moments going on, and then it can go and do something like this. And there's just very little that is willing to do that, because this is where that meditation element comes in. He doesn't make these things seem silly, even though they are very silly to some degree. Which I think is the only way you can tell stories about gods having people burst out of their foreheads or whatever. And to have these stories work, otherwise you look like gods of Egypt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can only imagine where we're going to go from here.
Yeah, the question is, will Evil Lincoln be back? And the answer is probably not. He's probably, that's all she wrote.
Lincoln must feast.
that guy 60 dead horse eyes ago.
He must hate Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right.
Taking all my good Lincoln roles.
It's like, what was it? Abraham Lincoln versus zombies. Yeah. A man divided upon himself cannot stand. What was it? With charity for none and malice for all. So on that note, we will leave you. We have the Heist. We'll probably come back. It may actually be beneficial, I'm thinking, to do these episodes as they go along.
Yeah.
I expected to talk about 35, 40 minutes about this. We've talked about an hour. So, but if you, for whatever reason, are listening to this and haven't watched it, and you're still on the fence, I mean, it's strange, but it is an experience. It is.
Yeah.
And it's an experience I think that's worth taking. The thing that we've said several times is that there is a method to Lynch's madness. There is, even if it's not a specific story he's trying to tell, he's trying to get at certain emotions. This isn't just throwing things at the wall to see them stick.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's hard to explain why that is. I mean, sometimes I think he is just doing things that don't necessarily connect to other things, but I think they're all for an overall feeling. It's an emotional, you know, people tell the story about the five blind guys that get together and find out they have an elephant, but they're not sure what they have to start with. You know, one guy's got an ear and he thinks he's got like a palm leaf, and the guy thinks he's got a snake, and then they all get together like, I have an elephant. I kind of feel like that's David Lynch and his like style a little bit is, you know, it's an elephant, or actually it's just pieces of an elephant that I cut up and handed to you silly blind guys. So anyway, have a good night, take care, and we will see you again soon. Thank you.